Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 5. Sandbutton Bridge. A quote from Georgine Millmine. They remember Mary Baker as a most interesting and beautiful child, dainty and fragile. As a young woman, she was slim, alert, and graceful. Of medium height, she had a well-formed figure. Her feet and hands were exquisitely fashioned. Her features were regular and refined. A delicately aquiline nose, a rather long and pointed chin, a firm mouth, and high broad forehead. But her most striking beauty lay in her big gray eyes, deep set and overhung by dark lashes. End quote. Some 30 years or more ago, seeking data for a series of articles on Mrs. Eddy, which subsequently appeared in McClure's magazine, Georgine Millmine, a New York newspaper woman, journeyed to New Hampshire and succeeded in finding quite a number of people who remembered Mary Baker as a young woman and had heard speak of her as a child. The foregoing description is from the record of what she found. It fits in very well with what little can be learned or inferred from early letters and other sources. She was a beautiful child and a beautiful woman. Indeed, all the Bakers were remarkable for their good looks. There is no early picture of Mary, as there is no picture at all of her mother. But one that is preserved of her eldest sister, Abigail, shows a woman of statuesque beauty and grace. While her father, as is seen from a picture taken in middle life, was tall and erect, with high brow and clear, piercing eyes. Mary always seems to have had the knack of dressing well. In practically every account that has been given of her, this fact is recorded, together with some comment expressing wonder as to how, in an out-of-the-way place like Bow, or even Sandbutton, she could have kept abreast, as she did, with the fashions of the day. In Sandbutton, some 30 or 40 years ago, it seems still to have been a matter of lively recollection how Mary Baker, Mark Baker's youngest girl, introduced to the little town the French twist, evidently a form of hairdressing which, in those days, was the last word. Sandbutton, or more correctly, Sandbutton Bridge, the Tilton of today, was, in the middle decades of last century, a thriving little mill town with woolen mills, grist mills, and cotton mills straggling up and down the Winnipesaukee River. The first settler was one Nathaniel Tilton, who came there in 1768. And 100 years later, when the town was incorporated, its name was changed to Tilton in his honor. At the time the Bakers arrived, the Tiltons, descendants of the original Nathaniel, were the most substantial people in town. Alexander Hamilton Tilton was a prosperous mill owner. The Tilton tweed, which he had invented, was known everywhere, and brought to him a large and increasing revenue. The fact that, within 2 years of the Baker's arrival, Alexander Tilton married Abigail Baker, Mary's eldest sister, would seem to show that from the first the two families were thrown much together, and that the Baker girls would have, in the way of social intercourse, all that Sandbutton had to offer. And Sandbutton apparently could do very well. It was no more than a small town, but after Beau, it must have seemed to Mary and her sisters a veritable whirl of social life. For Sandbutton did not depend only upon itself. All round about, wherever there was a stream with a good volume of water and a suitable fall, a dam had been laid, and a mill had been built, and a little settlement had sprung up. And Sandbutton Bridge visited friends in Sandbutton Square, or Franklin Falls, or Tin Corner, or the chapel, and vice versa. The bridge, as it was generally called, had a fine wide street, lined with shade trees and flanked by white houses with green shutters. It had a large church with a typical bullfinch steeple, while away above the town on Academy Hill was Sandbutton Academy, whose 100 or more students, boys and girls, formed a social center in itself. To Mary, it meant a new world. There is, it is true, the backward glance to Beau and Andrew already noted, but it is not long before Mary is writing to Sullivan of the various parties and weddings and excursions and what not, in which she and her sisters are taking part, and of the many new people she is meeting and the new friends she is making. In all, she expresses a natural and wholesome attitude in such typical tidbits as this. Quote, "I will give you an abridged sketch of a gentleman recently from Boston, now reading medicine with a doctor in this town. A perfect, complete gentleman. I met him a number of times at parties last winter. He invited me to go to the Shakers with him, but my superiors thought it would be a profanation of the Sabbath, and I accordingly did not go." End quote. And so it goes. Then there is the tremendous event of Abigail's wedding. It was to be a great affair, a real June wedding with all the friends of both families gathered together. But as was only proper 100 years ago, Mary, in writing about it to her brother Sullivan, had to express some due feeling of regret, if not actual sorrow, at the approaching separation. "She will be lost to us irrevocably, that is certain," she writes. And then, as if reluctant to surrender the luxury too quickly, she adds, "How changed is one short year! Dear brother, can you realize it with me? If so, take a retrospect view of home. See the remaining family placed round the blazing ingle, scarcely able to form a semicircle from the loss of its numbers." However, it is not long before she is herself again, quoting Burns and begging Sullivan to come and see them before long, when she promises not to be as sleepy as she and Abby were the last time. And now, letters from Albert begin to appear. He is in practice at Hillsborough, and with Franklin Pierce more and more preoccupied with politics, he is very busy. Too busy, in fact, for it is clear from his letters that he has already embarked upon that reckless spending of his energies which brought an untimely end to a more than ordinarily promising career some 4 years later. The relationships which existed between Mary and Albert and Mary and Sullivan present an interesting contrast. Sullivan was her gossip. She wrote to him about the little day-to-day happenings and knew he would be interested. But Albert was evidently reserved for more serious questions. Thus, on one occasion, the two sisters, Abigail and Mary, had evidently been the objects of some kind of village talk, and Abigail had written to Albert about it. And then, before he could reply, had written again to say that the matter had been cleared up. And so Albert writes to Mary to tell her how glad he is. "You cannot be too careful or too sensitive," he adds, "to the breath of slander, though you need never fear so long as you are innocent. The things always work their own way clear." It is sound advice, but the letter is chiefly interesting for the light it throws on Albert's outlook at that time. In the spring of 1837, Sandbutton Bridge had been the scene of one of those unbelievably vigorous revivalist missions which were wont periodically to descend on a New England town and sweep all before them. Abigail had evidently mentioned it in her last letter to Albert, and so Albert comments on it in this letter to Mary. "Abby informs me," he writes, "that there has lately been a protracted meeting at Sandbutton, and that you cherished a hope that you had been brought to embrace the doctrines of that religion, the strange influences of which have thus far puzzled philosophy to solve." Albert says he knows Mary will be anxious about how this information will affect him, but says there is no reason for her timidity, as he does not wish to discountenance religion. "For that matter, a woman can hardly live without it," he adds naively. And then he strikes a timely warning. "One thing, do not allow yourself to be suspected of bigotry or fanaticism. They are as distant from true religion as from true philosophy, its very antipodes." In order to appreciate the full significance of such a statement, it is necessary to understand, in a measure, the attitude at that time of the Orthodox New England evangelical religionist on this question of conversion. According to his view, a community was divided into three classes: the definitely converted, the hopefully inclined, and the finally lost. The finally lost were beyond the pale. As already noted, when Mary was 12, none of her brothers and sisters had made any definite profession. And it is evident from this letter that Albert is still very far from doing so, and that Mary is still holding out, although wavering. The letter clearly shows that the brother and sister must have talked the matter over many times, and a just inference seems to be that, while Mary steadfastly remained among the hopefully inclined, Albert had gone over to the finally lost. He had no desire, however, that Mary should follow him, and probably less positive now than he was in his Dartmouth days, is even anxious that Mary should feel free, if she should so desire, to cross over the border into the fold of the definitely converted. His only hope is that she retain that freedom from bigotry and fanaticism, which the two had evidently agreed was the only fitting attitude on religious questions. At Dartmouth, Albert had been much interested in mental and moral philosophy. As has been seen, he was an excellent scholar, a member of the Phi Beta Kappa, then as now a very definite gauge of scholarship. He was also a member and at one time vice president of the United Fraternity, a literary and debating society whose discussions on such subjects as is the evil of underrating our abilities greater than that of overrating them? And have the people the right to instruct their representatives? Attracted wide attention. It is interesting to note that, quite typically, Albert took the affirmative side in the first of the specific subjects mentioned, and the negative in the latter. In discussing such questions, he was evidently in his element. As his opponent for Congress, the Honorable Isaac Hill, wrote of him just after his death in 1841, he was fond of investigating abstruse and metaphysical principles, and he never forsook them until he had explored their every nook and corner, however hidden and remote. Thus, in Albert is seen all the elements which, years afterwards, were to compel his sister Mary into new fields in the realms of religion. He could not accept orthodox faith, but he was convinced that without that something which religion professed to give, man was a stranger in a strange land. And so he had the will to explore and the courage to keep on. Meanwhile, he writes to reassure Mary. If there was any further correspondence on the matter between the two during the year which followed, it has not been preserved. Anyway, in the summer of 1838, Mary took the step she had so long delayed. In that year, under date July 26th, was inscribed in the clerk's book of Sandbutton Congregational Church this notice. Received into this church, Stephen Grant, Esquire, John Silly and his wife Hannah, Mrs. Susan French, wife of William French, Miss Mary A.M. Baker, by profession the two former receiving the ordinance of baptism. Greenaw McQuestion, Scribe. Mary's letters during this period show that she was passing through a period of stress and doubt, and that continued ill health was beginning to raise questions in her mind, the answer to which was still 30 years or more away. It is, however, almost startling to find in one of her letters, a letter to Sullivan in the spring of 1837, the following passage. Martha has been very ill since our return from Concord. I should think her in a confirmed consumption, if I would admit the idea. But it may not be so, at least I hope not. The italics are Mary's. And in view of the fact that this thought was to appear some 30 or 40 years later as a fundamental mental attitude in the practice of Christian Science, the statement is interesting and significant enough. However, it was not all sickness or religious questionings with Mary in those days. She was living the life of a normal girl of her age and time, and in the early summer of 1838, her health evidently much improved, she attended Holmes Academy at Plymouth and set about the work of learning with that eager vigor which characterized her all too few opportunities for regular study. Mary was now 17, and for a brief time was able to be a typical schoolgirl of that age. She made friends easily, inspired devotion, and returned it wholeheartedly. And although, as was then only proper, it was always Miss Burnham, or Miss Howard, or Miss Shedd, or Miss Sutherland in her letters, such studied restraint had no concord with the normal abandon of her attachments. It was at Holmes Academy that she met Augusta Holmes, daughter of Nathaniel Holmes, a prominent mill owner of Sandbutton. The two girls were attracted to each other from the first, and the correspondence which passed between them after Augusta left Sandbutton and went to live with her family at Haverhill is refreshing for the way it runs true to form. At Sandbutton, the two were devoted to each other with a passion which only schoolgirls of 17 or 18 can compass. Mary is Augusta's little spouse, and Augusta is Mary's husband, and a younger girl, who appears only as Betsy R., is their daughter. It lasted, as do all such passions, through a summer day. And when Augusta returned to Haverhill, and a certain Enoch began to weave his disturbing way in and out of her letters, Mary, after a few doleful expressions of regret, resigns herself plaintively to the inevitable, and the relationship moves easily on to more solid ground. And the ground was solid enough. There is the usual gossip in the letters about parties and people, clothes and whatnot, but such questions as literature and religion occupy the greater part of them. Mary and Augusta are at the age when they are reading everything in sight, and it is a new world. They ask excited questions back and forth in a way suggestive of nothing so much as a slow motion picture of a telephone conversation, if such a thing can be conceived. Had Mary read Byron's Prisoner of Chillon? No, but she had read Corsair and Winifred. And did Augusta ever see Gaudy's Lady's Book? And did she possess a copy of Sir Walt's Grammar? And if so, would she lend it to her, as she heard that it was easier than Levizac's? And is she well, and did she get home safely? Mary's reading about this time was wide enough in its scope. In the scrapbook of her poems, which is still preserved, are many pages of manuscript devoted to extracts from Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Scott, Mrs. Hemans, Byron, and so on. Of these, Milton seems to have been her first and most lasting favorite. Literally, pages are devoted to transcribing portions of Paradise Lost. The main theme of it all is, of course, the joys of solitude, the pathetic beauty of nature, and the uncertainty of human life. Mary, however, was gaining an education in another way, by listening to and talking with other people. All her life, she had an extraordinary faculty for doing just this, for hurtling the elements of a new subject, and using with assurance information acquired perhaps only a few moments before. In early life, it is safe to say, she uniformly thought and talked beyond her years. And if she sometimes got out of her depth, her very daring had an evocative effect on her auditors. Thus, one of her teachers about this time was the Reverend Enoch Corser of Tilton Church. It was Dr. Corser who received her into church membership, and many years afterwards, his son Bartlett recalled the long religious discussions his father had had with Mary Baker, and how much the old Calvinist had admired her. "Bright, good, and pure, I brilliant," he declared to Bartlett one day, as they walked back from a visit to the Baker home. "I never before had a pupil with such depth and independence of thought. She has some great future, mark that. She is an intellectual and spiritual genius." To what extent Bartlett Corser's memory was irradiated by Mrs. Eddy's subsequent attainments, it is impossible to say. But there is evidence enough that Mary was thinking for herself, especially in the realm of religion. She passed through periods when she sought to whip herself into orthodoxy, when the orthodox idea of God as the great afflictor to the ends of good seemed the only possible view of the matter. And on one occasion, we find her begging Augusta to pray for her, declaring in true Jonathan Edwards style that she could not but be amazed at God's forbearance towards her. Indeed, she was getting religion from all sides now, and this, combined with increasing ill health and the tendency of the period to take a pseudo-pathetic view of life in general, plunged her often into the depths. She was really ill at times. The rigors of winter, which modern invention has done so much to modify, pressed hardly upon her, and her letters are full of colds and yet more colds, taken for granted as an inevitable accompaniment of the frost and snow of the dark days of the year in New Hampshire. Albert is often sorely anxious about it. In one letter home about this time, he speaks of how saddened he is to hear that Mary's health is again in danger. "I pray she will be more careful," he adds. "I fear she has exposed herself. Don't breathe these awful frosts. It is enough to break up the health of the stoutest. I have suffered from them of late, but am recovered." Albert, in fact, at times felt the strain very much. He had never spared himself, and his election to the state legislature in 1839 threw upon him a load of work which, in addition to his practice as a lawyer, was at times more than he could carry. He was never very robust. In a letter to his brother George, while he was reading law in Boston, under date of April 28, 1837, he tells him how he had just left hospital a day or two previously, and that he had done nothing since the 1st of March. Several times in his letters occurs the phrase, "If my health continues," and mention is made, as in the quotation above, of sickness from which he has recovered. After his election to the legislature, he took a prominent part in the business of the House. he was chairman of the select committee appointed to deal with the ever-present question of slavery, and was undeviating in his democratic devotion to states' rights. Sympathetic as he undoubtedly was towards the sentiments which advocated abolition, he favored the resolutions which rebuked abolitionist agitation, and recommended that Congress should not interfere with the slave trade between any states that desired this trade to continue. He was, moreover, in great demand as a speaker and lecturer. And when his friend Franklin Pierce went to Washington as a senator, the care of his practice, both at Hillsboro and Concord, devolved upon Albert. He is clearly being overworked, and it is not surprising to find him writing in a letter to Mary about this time, "I set out for Boston this morning. I am almost worn out. I have scarcely slept 2 hours for the last 2 days." Like Mary, however, he has periods when his health is unusually good, and then he forges ahead with redoubled energy. In the 3 years he was in the legislature, he piloted several important reforms through to the state statute book. Among these were the abolition of imprisonment for debt, the revision of the election laws, the protection of graves from molestation, the powers to be conferred on corporations, including railroads, whether a town should be allowed to buy stock in a railroad, the holding of courts at convenient times, and so on. And all the time, Senator Pierce from Washington was writing to his young partner, not only about laws, but about politics, and it began to be clear that Albert Baker had his feet definitely set on the road to Congress. It ought to have been a happy and inspiring period for both Albert and Mary. And so, to a certain extent, it was. Albert loved to work, as he himself often put it. And as long as he could work, even under difficulties, his natural buoyancy of spirit asserted itself. In his student days, he had written home to his brother Sullivan how that he had sold his college classics for a round sum of $10. And when that was gone, he would sell his shirt. "By the gods," he added, "I am as rich as a prince. What a glorious thing, this idea of borrowing money and dying insolvent." There is a laugh, of course, in every line of it, and there were many times later on when Albert could get back to where he was then. But the last few years of his life were overshadowed by ill health. In this respect, the brother and sister undoubtedly reacted unfavorably on each other. They worried over each other's health. His joy is saddened many times by the news from home, and his letters show him turning more and more for help and consolation to religion. He never seems to have reached the standpoint of the definitely converted, but he had quite evidently ceased to find any satisfaction in numbering himself among the finally lost. Thus, in a letter to Mary during one of her periods of sickness, he says he hopes his sister is enjoying good health. But even if not, she should maintain an attitude of calmness and resignation, since Providence is inscrutable. He adds that he sees the hand of God in events, good and evil. God rules, let the earth submit. That was in 1840. The following year, he was nominated to Congress in a district where election was certain. But he died some 2 weeks before Election Day, on October 21, 1841. His death was a cruel shock to his family and friends, but to no one more than to Mary. One rather pitiful little poem in which she expects soon to follow her brother and wonders whether her friends will miss her or forget her is the only reference to her sorrow that has been preserved.